You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In a Spanish court this past March, human rights lawyers filed a suit against six former Bush administration officials, accusing them of providing legal cover for the use of torture of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Spain, they argued, has legal jurisdiction under international law because five former Guantanamo inmates, three of them Spanish citizens and two Spanish residents, have said that they were tortured. To understand the basis of their case, it might be best to consult a book called Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values, written by Philippe Sands, a practicing barrister and professor of law at University College London. The book is published by Palgrave Macmillan. I'm very pleased that it brings Philippe Sands to the show today. Hello.
I'm delighted to join you.
And the book was first published in 2008. This is, it's just been recently updated and released in paperback?
Yes, it came out in April 2008, and this is the paperback. It had, you refer to the Spanish proceedings, it had, I think, a certain impact in those proceedings. And 6 months or so after it came out, I got a call somewhat out of the blue from a Spanish lawyer saying he'd read my book and he was acting for certain people and it had informed his views and he wanted to initiate a complaint against these lawyers.
Well, hadn't you predicted at some point that in the future, six top officials of the Bush administration would be arrested on international charges of torture?
I think it wasn't entirely coincidental. I'd been involved a decade ago in a very famous case involving Senator Augusto Pinochet, which had raised the issue of the crime of torture and the question of exercise of jurisdiction by foreign courts. And I'd always been interested when the documents started coming out after the Abu Ghraib pictures were released. How could the lawyers have done it? That's really why I focused on the lawyers.
You had been invited to represent Pinochet, and you declined?
I had been invited, and I did decline. We're not allowed.
Don't lawyers take any case?
Well, we are. We're it's called the cab rank principle in England for barristers. We're supposed to take anyone that comes along. I had a rather powerful American wife, a New Yorker, I have to say, and she was less than thrilled because half her family lives in Spain and is of a particular political persuasion. I managed to wiggle out of it. We have a thing called professional embarrassment exception. I'd given a radio interview saying he shouldn't have immunity, and on that basis, I wiggled out of it.
And you then worked for the other side?
I then was approached by a body based in New York, actually. Again, there's a lot of New York-related stuff here, Human Rights Watch, and they retained me. They intervened, and we ended up winning the case.
Does this case, the case against the American officials, to some degree depend on arguments made at Nuremberg, that there's no immunity for the highest-ranking former government officials when they're accused of committing crimes like torture?
It doesn't depend on the Nuremberg precedent, but it's closely related to it. There are now, since Nuremberg, a raft of international conventions, which actually the U.S. has done more than any other country to put in place, famously the Geneva Conventions, the Convention Against Torture, and they create an obligation to investigate, and there's no entitlement to immunity.
Now, Spain went after Pinochet, and Spain pursued this case at least for a time. Is Spain the only country where this sort of thing is happening?
Or no, Spain, Spain is still pursuing this case, and this case will go forward. And this case is bringing particular pressure on the Obama administration to do something. There are criminal investigations in Britain, in my country, and I suspect that there will be criminal investigations in other parts of the world because the detainees come from so many different countries.
This is different than the sort of thing that we saw after the Vietnam War where American officials were tried in absentia in different parts of the world?
No, it's very different. The law has moved on. You've got international conventions. You've got precedents. You've got international courts and tribunals. We're in a very different situation. And I think the advice at the Bush Six, as they've come to be known, as I suspect, don't set foot outside this country.
Well, didn't Spain's Attorney General say that going after lawyers or legal advisors without going after their bosses, that is, President Bush and other top officials, was a legal artifice that would pose some problems?
Well, that was one of the many things that the delightfully named Candidou Pompidou said. He also said that Garzon was going after the wrong people. He should go against the people who were in the room doing the abuse. 6 hours later, President Obama rebutted that and said, no, that's not right. We're going to give those people a sort of immunity. We're not going to go against them if they relied on these dreadful legal memos in good faith. But President Obama then said, as regards the framers of the legal decision, that is a different matter. And he opened the door to criminal investigations.
And these are the framers of the legal decision.
Yeah, the Bush Six, amongst others. I think the list is about to be extended. Your question was, do you go up the chain of command? I think that's a tactical issue. I mean, you have to ask yourself the question, if you were a prosecuting judge, would you go against the main men and women today? There are political issues raised with doing that.
That would be President Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld?
Well, amongst others, but of course there's new material that's come out very recently which tends to show that other high-ranking officials, CIA Director George Tenet, former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, were involved in the decision directly to authorize waterboarding.
Well, the six that we have here are all well-known by now: Alberto Gonzalez, John Yoo, Douglas Feith, William J. Haynes, J.S. Bybee, and David S. Addington, Addington being the most fascinating and mysterious of the bunch. But didn't you speak to Douglas Feith when you were researching the book?
I spoke to several of these characters. They weren't, in fact, all well-known names when I started on this little personal research and writing endeavor. Doug Feith was one who was well-known. I was very pleased and grateful to him for meeting with me. We spent a couple of hours together. We talked about a range of things.
Was he forthcoming?
He was very forthcoming. He has advantages and disadvantages. One of his great merits is he speaks probably more than he should. And he described to me in rather forceful terms the central role he played, in my view, in getting rid of Geneva. And then sort of told me a bit of a porky pie when he said that he had had nothing to do with the issue of interrogations. And, of course, the documents that I had, and it's now confirmed, tell a rather different story. So he speaks rather too much, and every word he speaks ends up in the Audiencia Nacional in Madrid.
Were you surprised that when your book was first published, he dismissed you as a British lawyer who wrote an extremely dishonest book?
Oh, I was delighted. What more can one expect than the oxygen of publicity coming from Doug Feith, the best man a publicist could hope to have? I've, of course, reflected very carefully on every word he has said, and in writing the paperback, the issue arose, should I change anything? Should I come back to some of his arguments? In fact, I haven't changed a word. I've looked at it very carefully. It's been fact-checked very carefully. An extract was published by Vanity Fair magazine. They sent a fact-checker to London for a week, something they'd never done before. We stood by absolutely everything, and I think time will show I'm right, he's wrong.
You also debated in 2005 John Yoo. Was he famous at that time?
He was less famous than he is now. He's a rather, I thought, slippery character. Every time I try to confront him with a hard fact, he'd sort of wiggle out of it. And he's quite sort of unctuous. And I didn't, I have to say, make a great deal of progress with him until he started being rude about me. He said that the problem was it's impossible to debate people with me who have accents like I have coming from Eton. Just for the record, I didn't go to Eton. And he turned a little nasty, so it became...
He was doing the... using the... he's an elitist,
yes,
argument against
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. John Yoo proposes that he speaks for the people. I'm just some Brit foreign elite type of character. But again, I think he's in serious difficulty now.
What was the topic that you were debating?
It was October 2005. It was before this issue became fashionable. And we were talking about issues of abuse and executive authority of presidents. And I confronted him directly with the Pinochet president. And I said I thought he would face difficulty in the future. And he wouldn't engage on it.
He argued that pressing challenges to the international order and to American national security, such as international terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, proliferation, rogue states, have highlighted the failure of or obsolescence of some elements of the international legal system.
Well, I think, with great respect, he's wrong. I'm not starry-eyed about international law. It's plainly there are bits of it that got to be looked at. But one thing you don't do is abandon your value system. And your value system includes that we do not torture. And you just need to ask yourself this question. And I put this, in fact, to General Myers and to various other people that I interviewed, as I describe in the book. Could you imagine any of these techniques being used against an American in any circumstances? And I got instantaneous responses in every case when I put the question like that. The answer is no. So what this is really about is abusing the other. And that is at the heart of what this issue really is about.
We were outraged when torture was applied to Americans in Vietnam and Korea earlier. So,
well, it now turns out that we have learnt that the techniques we are now, or we applied on people at Guantanamo and elsewhere, were taken from those very sources that we used on Americans. But you recall, Leonard, the reaction when a small number of American prisoners of war were paraded in the streets of Baghdad, the instantaneous, overwhelmingly negative, massive reaction against that. Imagine for a moment if a foreign government were to take one of these opinions drafted and crafted by Messrs. Yu and Bybee and say, look, we can do this. Waterboarding's fine. Let's do it on this American we've captured. You don't need to reflect for very long on what the reaction would be.
Frank Rich called Philippe Sand's book, Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values, an essential book on what happened. It's been updated since its publication last year. Even though Wu wrote a number of legal opinions, you actually begin your book with the one that's signed by then Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. He's not even named as a defendant. What was the memo, and which you have a piece of on the cover of the book, and why isn't he one of the defendants?
It's a fascinating document. It was written by his lawyer, Jim Haynes, on the 27th of November 2002. It's a one-pager. It was signed...
Now, you spoke to Jim Haynes as well.
I did, and I'll come on to that in a moment. That was a fascinating conversation, two conversations. The memo authorizes 18 techniques, or 15 techniques of interrogation for blanket use, stress position, standing, forced nudity, dogs, and so on and so forth. In fact, the things we associate with the pictures of abuse at Abu Ghraib, and left then for subsequent determination on a case-by-case basis, three other techniques, including waterboarding. I looked at this document. I'm trained, whether as an academic or as a barrister, to look at documents carefully, and I smelt a rat, because the narrative the administration told was that this had come from the bottom up. A few folks at Guantanamo had crafted this, and the administration was simply acting as a prudent government and doing a responsive thing. And my book is the story of how I went around meeting everyone involved in that memo to find out what had really happened.
Well, they say that history is the story that's written by the victors. Donald Rumsfeld has always answered his detractors by claiming that history will one day judge him kindly.
Well, I think he's obviously entitled to make that point. I think that is unlikely, and I think we've already seen that the reaction, the recruiting effect that these techniques has had, the decline of this country's authority, its ability to play a leadership role, speaks very, very clearly. And you know, we've got experience in Britain about these things. For a very short period in 1970, Britain moved to use similar techniques against a very small number. I think it was just 18 members of the IRA. It was soon seen this was a recruiting tool. 38 years on, we are still paying the price of that. 38 years on, there are still inquiries going on about what happened.
Well, in the case of the Yu secret memorandums and the ones from other top administration lawyers that cleared the way for aggressive policies like waterboarding and other harsh interrogation techniques, what constitutional grounds did they use to determine that it was legal to use any means necessary to extract information?
Well, none that are particularly compelling, I've got to say. I mean, I think what your listeners should do, if they can bear it, is just read one of these documents. The most recent one was released by President Obama a month or so ago. It's not very long. It's 18 pages, double-spaced. It is written by Jay Bybee. It's dated the 1st of August 2002, crafted by John Yu. Read that document and look for the legal analysis. The classical defining feature of a decent legal opinion is its engagement with past authorities, with precedents. None of that is there. This is what it is it's sign-off by the lawyers of a predetermined policy of abuse. And you get that in the rather shocking last line of the memo. If we can be of further assistance, please don't hesitate to be in touch.
We'll come up with some other arguments.
No doubt.
Philippe Sands is a practicing attorney and professor of law at University College London and author of Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values, now available in paperback from Palgrave Macmillan, updated from with new material since the release of the hardcover last year. We will continue our conversation after this. Later on in the show, British historian Simon Sharma traces four themes throughout American history, and then we look into what happened in the New World between Columbus's sail in 1492 and the arrival of the pilgrims in 1620. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Philippe Sands talking about his book Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values, now available in paperback from Palgrave Macmillan. You told me you wanted to add something to what you've been saying before we move on.
Your crucial question, Leonard, why not go higher up the chain? And I think this is a complex question. I think eventually that is going to happen. It may happen sooner than we imagine. We hear that Judge Baltazar Garzon in Spain is looking to add to the list beyond the Bush Six. But I think there's a tactical issue. What sort of backlash would it cause within the United States to go higher up the chain now? It may be that now is the right moment in relation to two individuals in particular, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, at least. That's what some people are suggesting. But I think it's a tactical issue. At the end of the day, your question is right. The responsibility goes to the top, not just to the lawyers.
But the president has also said he doesn't want to go down any. After he released the documents that detailed brutal interrogation methods, he tried to pressure CIA operatives or try to reassure them that they would not be prosecuted. Do you think that that was the right decision?
His choice of words was significant. He didn't want to target CIA interrogators who relied in good faith on these legal memos. And I think I defended that position. Actually.
Well, that position was not accepted in Germany after World War II.
It wasn't accepted, and I defended it in the political context that appears now for the time being on this approach. Right now, is it a sensible use of limited time and human energy to go for those kinds of characters when there are bigger fish to fry? And I think that is the right position.
What does historical precedent tell us? Didn't issues like this come up during the Civil War?
Indeed, they did. And I go back in the book to tell the story of how President Lincoln in 1863 determined that the U.S. military will never engage in cruelty, even when necessity is invoked to justify it. And the remarkable thing about the document that we were talking about earlier, the Rumsfeld memo, the December 2002 one-pager, is it appears to be the very first time in about 140 years, that in a formal sense, that determination by President Lincoln has been done away with. And that was really what caused me to do what I did and to find out what happened to allow the U.S. to abandon a long and honorable position.
It's interesting that Lincoln was willing to put aside habeas corpus for a while, but not this.
It is interesting. I'm still getting my mind around how he drew a distinction between those two elements. I'm not yet there, but he was always very clear about abuse. It is wrong because it is not who we are.
In the lead up to this, we had a lot of discussion about the possibility of using torture before. I'm not sure if it was before 9/11, but somewhere around that time, Alan Dershowitz wrote a book about the ticking bomb concept, in which he didn't take a position, but he threw open the idea that you might want to use torture in certain cases.
I think he did take a position. He published that book in August 2002. It's not clear whether he was aware that at that very moment, the Bush administration was on the cusp of authorizing waterboarding. I can tell you from the conversations I had, for example, with Diane Beaver and Mike Gellis down at Guantanamo, respectively a lawyer and a clinical psychologist, they were aware of what Alan Dershowitz was writing, and it had an impact. It basically sent out a signal. If a Harvard Law School professor is saying we can move to torture under certain conditions, that created conditions at Guantanamo in which it was more likely to happen.
Well, in his defense, I have to say, because I moderated a discussion between Alan Dershowitz and Ed Koch, who was gung-ho for torture. Dershowitz, I had been brought in because they realized that they were not going to get along. Dershowitz was taking a more nuanced position, but in the end we wound up with a television show that suggested that there are ticking bomb scenarios.
Well, I debated Alan at Harvard Law School on exactly this issue. We had a tremendous discussion. I think that by writing a book countenancing the possible or the use of torture warrants in certain circumstances, you are in effect opening the door to torture. He protested strongly. He does not support torture. I think that's wrong. I don't think anyone's actually come up with a single example of where the ticking time bomb scenario works. I'm against torture because it's not who we are. I'm against it because it doesn't work. I've met many interrogators. Each one has said to me it doesn't produce useful information. It produces information, but you don't know how real it is.
Because they may be telling you just what they think you want to
hear. Because they're telling you what they think you want to hear. I mean, interrogator after interrogator would say to me, the only moment at which abuse might work, and none of them said they supported even that, is at the moment of capture. Abusing someone, torturing someone 6 months, 9 months, a year, 2 years after they've been captured is a totally useless exercise.
On your website, you actually have some of the records of the interrogation methods employed. How reliable are those documents?
Well, that is, you're referring to the 84-page memorandum, which is the interrogation log partial of Mohammed al-Qahtani, detainee 063, alleged to be the 20th hijacker. That document is authentic. I don't think that it's complete. And I think that there is more to come out. We now know also that there were video tapes, that there were audio tapes of his interrogation. Those have not yet emerged. And the question arises, were those two destroyed like the CIA tapes?
Even if they weren't, isn't it likely that President Obama will not allow them to be released because he has decided not to release photos of the abuse on the grounds that it might endanger American military personnel abroad?
Well, I'm disappointed that he decided not to release those 44 photos. I'm told that they do contain some pretty shocking material. The most significant thing about the photos is that they confirm the abuse was widespread, i.e. not just limited to Iraq and to Abu Ghraib, but included Bagram and Guantanamo. I think he will change his mind. I think he's playing the long game.
But you have argued that the use of brutal interrogation techniques enrages communities. And the argument is that this would just exacerbate the situation. Why wouldn't you go along with what the president
decided? Well, I think that the photos, in a sense, are already out there. And he's right in that sense. I think the damage is done in terms of the enraging of new communities. And I think putting out new photos now is unlikely to add. Those who want to be enraged will be enraged. The bigger issue is understanding what happened. That's the crucial issue. I have to say, it's my own experience. I did a conversation in Belfast and someone put a hand up and said she was a former member of the IRA, had been interned by the Brits. And it was the moment when the Brits moved to these techniques of interrogation that the IRA recruitment in 1970 and 71 went into overdrive.
Well, Britain has a lot more ability to keep secrets. Would something like this even have come out?
Well, one of the remarkable things for me, I'm often asked what's the most surprising thing I came across, was the way in which doors would open at the highest levels and I'd get access to speak to people. I mean, my book is a tale of me traipsing around the United States, knocking on doors, and everyone I wanted to speak to all intents and purposes, spoke. That's a remarkable testament to an open country, which is why I think President Obama's decision of last week is counterintuitive. It won't sustain the test of time, and ultimately these images will emerge.
Because we don't have an Official Secrets Act.
Happily, you don't have an Official Secrets Act, and it does have, I can tell you, a very chilling effect on free speech.
Philippe Sands' book, Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values, updated with major new details, has been issued in paperback by Palgrave Macmillan. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In hearings on the use of interrogation tactics, one member of the committee, Representative Trent Franks of Arizona, a Republican, said the results of a total of 3 minutes of severe interrogations of three of the worst terrorists were of immeasurable benefit to the American people. A full 25% of human intelligence we received on al-Qaeda came from just 3 minutes worth of rarely used interrogation tactics.
I remember it well. The book caused hearings to be held in the House Judiciary Committee. I flew over. I testified on a couple of occasions. He had a real go at me. He just said, look, basically, I paraphrase him here, what are you whinging on about? You know, it was limited and it produced results. Now, I wasn't in a position to challenge what he was telling me on the facts. He tells me it was done to three people for a minute each, grand total 3 minutes. He tells me he's been told that by the CIA director. Who am I to challenge that? We now know he wasn't accurate. We now know that two individuals were waterboarded for in excess of 260 occasions. That is what one of these memos unwittingly released. So the factual basis of his argument, I think, is false. But even if he was right, it gets back to the point of principle. It is not who we are. And even if it worked, I would be against it for that reason, because of its recruiting and engaging consequences.
So is that what you would say to former Vice President Dick Cheney? Because he has said that the information we got from using those techniques kept Americans safe after 9/11.
Well, I think let's call a spade a spade. I think the Vice President is a torturer, and he should be criminally investigated for torture. And every word that comes out of his mouth digs him more deeply into a big hole. I don't think it has made America safe. I don't think it's made Britain safer. I think it has enraged sectors of the population. It has made us much more vulnerable to further attack. I'm very distressed by him taking to the airwaves and making that sort of argument. And when he tells me he's seen the memos that show that this worked, I recall that he also famously on the 27th of August 2002 told a group of American veterans, "I've seen the memos that confirm unequivocally that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction." So frankly, I take with a pinch of salt the veracity of what he says, but I get back to the basic point. He authorized torture. He is a torturer.
Well, the person who helped him authorize torture is David Addington, somebody who we're unlikely to see on television. Do you think that he really is the architect of what we have been going through?
One of the things that I uncovered, and I think this was not previously known, was that he led a delegation down to Guantanamo at a crucial moment on the 25th of September 2002. And he met with the interrogators down there and the lawyers and the head of interrogation, and he left them on two accounts, as I was told, with the message, do what needs to be done. I was told he was a scary character, a big booming voice. We have seen him now. He was subpoenaed by the House Judiciary Committee as a consequence of the hearings that were catalyzed by the book. He did turn up. You can judge for yourself, and your listeners can go onto YouTube and watch him. It was a boisterous, tough, aggressive, hubristic performance, but one that was also factually inaccurate.
What do you make of Nancy Pelosi's current difficulties?
I don't want to be partisan about it. If she was told that waterboarding could happen or would happen or had happened, then we need to get to the facts about what happened. I have to say that watching her body language very, very carefully and comparing her various statements, it appears that there is something in what she says that has to be looked at a little more carefully. It may be that she's completely exonerated, that her final statement is accurate. She was never told that anybody actually was waterboarded. I don't buy the argument that she was sworn to secrecy and therefore couldn't talk about it. When you are presented with acts that are plainly torture, it gets back to your question, points of official secrecy, I think, go out of the window. But I would want to look at that further.
On the other hand, that was a rough time for somebody to say that the government was acting tough, because you would have been called a traitor. People were being called treasonous for a lot less than that.
They were. Well, you know, Leonard, I was in New York at the time. I taught for 10 years at NYU Law School. And so I was in New York. I saw the whole thing happen. I was teaching at NYU Law School on September the 11th. And I'm acutely aware of that day, as you are and many, many other people were. It doesn't justify what happened. Large parts of the American media went to sleep after that day, and they didn't wake up again until the photographs of Abu Ghraib were pictured. There were very honorable exceptions, people like Jane Mayer at The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books and The Nation magazine and The Village Voice, but they were few and far between. Many of my friends, lawyers teaching at wonderful law schools, also didn't stick their head above the parapet in the U.S. in that period. There was a climate of fear, and I think the lesson that we have learned from this is that when independent voices are shut off, very bad things happen.
Isn't there still something of a climate of fear? The Democrats aren't planning to approve President Obama's $80 million request to close Guantanamo. The FBI director says, what will we do with detainees who have been tortured? Nobody wants them, least of all the United States.
Well, there's a real problem. Some of these characters, no doubt, are problem characters. Others are, I think, wholly innocent and, you know, wouldn't cause any threat to anybody. The Europeans are going to have to pull their weight. But I think the Europeans are going to start saying to themselves, look, we'll take some of these people, but you've got to sort out the issues in your back garden. You've got to start looking at what happened. You've got to have the sort of investigations that the British are now undertaking, that the Spaniards are now undertaking, to get to truth about what happened. I think Obama faces a very delicate balancing exercise. I wish he'd just get off the fence and basically do what Frank Rich said he should do, start a proper investigation.
Do you think a truth and reconciliation approach might be better because it would not involve prosecuting people?
It might, and I've got a very open mind on which approach is better. I recognize that criminal investigations have a chilling effect on the emergence of important information and on the willingness of people who were involved directly or indirectly to come forward. But something will happen, and I think it's a dead cert that something will happen. It's the American way that you get to the bottom about this. They did a commission on 9/11. There will be a commission, and Obama should just get on with it.
Just one more thing. What would be so terrible about bringing these prisoners into American prisons? After all, as Dick Durbin points out, there are other equally dangerous people already in our high-security prisons.
Nothing at all. I watched the debate with incredulity. It is what we call in England NIMBYism, not in my backyard. There are far, far worse people around. It relates also to President Obama's decision to reinvigorate the process of military tribunals, a terrible decision. These people should not be dealt with by process which would essentially characterize them as warriors. The criminal process is the best way to go. I deeply regret he hasn't gone that way.
Philippe Sands is a lawyer and a professor of law at University College London. His book, Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values, updated with major new details, is now available in paperback from Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you so much for having me, Leonard.
Up next, another Brit talking about America. Simon Sharma looks at four contentious issues that have divided Americans since its founding. By the way, you might want to know that you can join Terrence McKnight and David Garland on Evening Music for WNYC's annual American Music Festival, which kicks off tomorrow night with a live broadcast by Grizzly Bear and ends with a free concert in the Green Space. As I said, it starts tomorrow night at 7 on 93.9 FM, WNYC. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.